You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamani here for Hannah Ross Tokuingua, and welcome to the best bits of BFM current affairs this week. This week was American commentator for 95BFM, Jason Leopold, last state of the states. A new survey with some pressing details about teaching staff and students came out on the Tertiary Education Union and claims the village the SAS raid mentioned in the recent Nikki Hager book Hit and Run did not actually exist came out. Firstly, this week saw Jason Leopold's last State of the States installment. He had been corresponding for BFM for 10 years now, and he spoke to Pearl a little about the links between Donald Trump's staff and Russia.
The sort of the last thing I wanted to touch on was the continued almost narrative of Trump's staff and their relationships with Russia. I saw something this week about Jared Kushner, who is Ivanka's husband's relationship with Russia, sort of under scrutiny. What's the deal with that?
It's really unbelievable the extent to which we're learning how many individuals within this administration, not just, you know, having a relationship with Russia, but having meetings, having, you know, business dealings with, you know, with Russia and not disclosing it. And so with Jared Kushner, that certainly, you know, has come up. It's a surprise. He's supposed to testify, you know, before a congressional committee to discuss this. And we don't exactly know the extent to which, you know, what are his dealings. We do know that, you know, Jared Kushner is a very wealthy businessman. You know, a developer. He owns many properties. He develops properties. So on the one hand, it would not be unusual to say, you know, have some business dealings with, you know, with foreign governments.
Right.
What's really questionable here, however, is the fact that it really does appear that, you know, members of this administration have gone to great lengths to hide it. To hide those business dealings. When questioned about it, you know, they are quite coy, you know, in their response. And then we've learned, obviously, through, you know, other members of the administration, their relationships have gone, you know, or their relationships are much deeper. And of course, you know, why is this an issue? Well, it's an issue because, you know, according to the intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies, that Russia played a direct role trying to shift the election, presidential election, to Donald Trump, you know, was involved in the influencing of this election through, you know, hiring or third-party actors who, you know, hacked email. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of Russia rhetoric. There's certainly you know, anything that is closely connected to Russia seems to be suspect. And I think that's a bit of an overreach. But when the, you know, right now, what we're trying to find out is exactly what are the relationships that are currently in place. And, you know, we have a businessman, you know, Donald Trump, very wealthy, who continues to obviously play a central role in his own business. They have people that he's closely, you know, connected with, his own family, you know, that have business dealings around the world. And how will that impact the presidency? How, you know, does that mean he's sort of, you know, how will those dealings continue? And then the other side of it, what Congress wants to know is, what are they hiding? You know, what did they know? What did they know when? Why are they not discussing it? So right now we're just trying to find out, or they're trying to find out, the extent to which Jared Kushner has a relationship. Who does he know? Who has he met with? What have they discussed? Did they discuss anything about politics? Did they discuss anything about the presidential campaign? When did that relationship start? Those are the types of questions that you can expect to hear.
I mean, what do you think will come of these investigations, into Trump's team's relationship with Russia? I mean, do you think anything major would, do you think, I mean, in the most extreme case, anything will be grounds for impeachment, or do you just think that's so unlikely?
You know, that's really, really a great question, because it's the question that I certainly have been asking, members of Congress since these investigations started, and it doesn't seem to be the types of questions that others are asking. So essentially, we know that there's a number of investigations that are taking place, right? Mm. What will ultimately happen? They'll write a report. Congress will write a report much in the same way that the members of Congress wrote a report about the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, right?
Right.
They wrote that report. They basically said that, more or less, the Bush administration was lying. People lied us. The highest levels of government lied us into war.
Mm.
What happened? Nothing. So nothing happened. We went to war on a lie, and nobody lost their jobs. Nobody was jailed. Nobody was impeached. I would say that you can expect the exact same thing to happen here. One, yeah. You can't have any, it's unlikely to see any sort of impeachment proceedings first and foremost, because the Democrats, they're not running the show, and they don't have a majority in either house. They can introduce, articles of impeachment. But I think ultimately what we're going to be stuck with, and what the public is always stuck with in the end, is, Congress investigated, they wrote a report, and now that report's on the public record. Maybe it sort of discredits the administration's, the fact that this administration, got into the White House ultimately, but what sort of impact? That's unclear, and I think that you can pretty much, if history is any teacher, expect that nothing will happen.
And that was Jason Leopold with Pearl Little. A recent survey on the Tertiary Education Union members found 63% of academics are feeling more pressured to pass students over the past decade, as well as 66% of university staff feeling that there is more pressure to admit students that do not meet prerequisites. Sandra Gray spoke to us regarding this.
And what do you think is going to happen if the change doesn't occur, if the government doesn't let down on these restrictions and tertiary institutions don't remove the restrictions from their staff members?
What we're already seeing, and this is the sad fact, is really good teachers are walking away, really good academics, really good lecturers and tutors are going, I've had enough of this. I can no longer justify working in this system. And that's really bad for students, because, we need good people in those classrooms. We need good people in those lecture theatres, those labs, those tute rooms. We need to keep good staff. And so that's one consequence. The other is that, the government and the institutions need to face up to the fact that students aren't going to put up with this. Students are actually going to say, enough's enough. We want a good quality experience. We want to make sure that we get out of our education system what we should, which is skills and knowledge and ideas and creative ways of thinking that help us through the rest of our lives. So, the students won't stand for this, and they will either go elsewhere or they'll find other ways of learning and other ways of engaging and creating the skills they need for life. And, that's not a good thing for the system. We want students to enjoy what they do. We want students to get the most out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I must say, the one thing that really stands out from the survey for me, from the staff, is one of the very closing comments from one of our respondents was, they said, I go to work every day with knots in my stomach. So just, making staff very sick. But they said, I keep going. I keep going for my students' sake, because they need me to be there. So, we keep going because we really, really, really want every student to have an excellent experience in our spaces, with us, with the learning. And, I hate to say it, but it's making people sick. And that isn't something that can continue.
Mm. So do you think it's negatively affecting the mental health of teachers?
It's absolutely affecting the well-being of teachers. It's March only. We're only 3 months into the year, and I've been in a number of institutions where staff members are already on stress leave. Their doctors have said, you are too sick to work. The stress of your employment is making you so sick, I need you to take 2 weeks off. That shows you the stress levels in the sector. We have people whose personal well-being is being undermined. Now, the thing about that is not only is that bad for that person and their family, but actually the students are then missing out because, you know, they need those permanent staff, those good quality teachers in the classrooms with them, and they need teachers who have the energy to deal with all the complexities that a classroom brings. And people who are unwell, you know, aren't able to be there for their students. And so, you know, the system is harming people, real people.
And that was Sandra Gray with Joel Little. New information emerged that suggests the village the New Zealand Defence Force claims the SAS raid took place in actually doesn't even exist. Shamina Smith spoke to one of the lawyers representing the villagers from Kakukudai Dad and Nak, Deborah Manning, about this new information.
So this morning we sent correspondence off to the Attorney General and the Prime Minister just about the NZDF map that's been relied upon, just to confirm with them that where they've operated, where they have identified that they had their operation is in fact where our clients' villages are.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I guess in the statement that you've released today, you've basically contested some of the key statements from the New Zealand Defence Force's media release and subsequent press conference, one of which being that Turjaran Village doesn't actually exist.
Yes, well, Tegaran Valley is a valley, and so it's just like saying Otago is a city. It's not, it's an area. Or Waitakere Rangers saying Waitakere Village. We all know that it's there is no village called Waitakere. So, look, where we're coming from is that our clients know the names of their villages, and they know that in 2010 they were the subject of a military operation. So, you know, they're very clear that, you know, they suffered terribly that night, and they wish for there to be a formal and independent inquiry into what took place during what we now know to be called Operation Burnham.
And so there's the village that doesn't exist. That's one point from your release. What were the other sort of key things that the Defence Force got wrong?
So essentially that Defence Force map identifies three villages. One of them doesn't exist, Tegaran Village, which I've just gone through. The other two they've labelled as my clients' villages of Kakuradad and Nayak. In fact, those are other villages, and their village is in the place that's been identified as a non-existent village. And, you know, this all makes sense because it's clear, I think clear to everyone, that, you know, both the hit and run book and the NZDF conference are talking about the same incident. Mm. And so my clients, again, are just confirming that they know the name of their village, they know where they were, and they know what happened on that night, and that civilians, you know, were killed, including little three-year-old Fatima. Mm.
And so why do you think the Defence Force's account of the raid is so starkly different to what your clients are saying and what Nikki Hager and John Stevenson are saying?
Well, all I can say is that we need to have an independent inquiry to look into what happened. As I say, my clients know what happened to them, and they want to know what, you know, the New Zealand Defence Force's role in that night were. And so in our view, everything in the last week just continues over and over again to reinforce the need for an independent inquiry.
But also I will point out that the SAS on Monday, Lieutenant General Tim Keating said that the SAS had never been to the villages named in the book and that he had geo-referenced video footage which proved this to be irrefutable. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement, is it not?
Well, look, you know, I don't really want to get into all the detail, but what I would say is that having geo-referenced detail isn't the same as knowing the name of the village that you were in. Mm. Look, I really don't know what has happened. I can't speak for the NZDF. I can't speak for who created that map or why they labelled it the way that they did. What I can say, you know, again, is that night in Tegaran area, there was only one military raid. Everyone agrees on that. And my clients say that occurred in their village. Mm.
And so how likely is an inquiry at this stage?
Well, we've written formally to the Attorney General and the Prime Minister to ask them for that, and so we will give them the opportunity to consider our request and the reasons for it. I mean, I would note that the Chief of the Defence Force said he wasn't against an inquiry, but that he required a legal basis for that, and so we have now provided that legal basis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we hope that an inquiry will, you know, will occur, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Right, so hopefully this will be enough to stimulate the Defence Force into conducting that inquiry.
I hope so.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.